Okay, we're going to take your phone calls now with our special guest, Paul Smith, in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Paul, has anybody tried to use remote viewing to find the lost Ark of the Covenant or anything like that?
Yes, as a matter of fact. When we were at Fort Meade, there were a number of sessions worked by various viewers there, which tried to describe the location, the current location of the Ark of the Covenant.
Oh, really?
It was interesting.
To say the least. You know, there are some people out there now who think that they're very close to finding it. I wonder if those individuals have used remote viewers to assist them.
It's hard to say. You know, of course, remote viewing has been used in archaeological exploration before. And I'm a little promotion here. In fact, at the remote viewing conference, one of those remote viewers is going to be one of our main speakers. I don't think he has worked. His name is George McMullen. I don't think he has worked on the Ark of the Covenant, but I think that it would be a good tool, a useful tool, because there's been success. George is quite successful in that. And you know, it would be intriguing. I know the data that the remote viewers at Fort Meade produced, and I have to, first of all, caveat, it was not an official operation. This was one that was done just on our own. Again, Ed Dames was the ringleader, we, in fact, if our bosses had known we were doing it, they probably would have been mad at us. But nonetheless, the data was fairly consistent across the remote viewing sessions, and some of them I'm not sure, they may have been front-loaded, but several of them I know were absolutely blind. The viewers had no idea what the target was, including myself, and yet our data seemed to cross-correlate quite persuasively. That data seemed to reveal, and I won't say more about it than this, seemed to reveal that the Ark was still in some place in the Middle East, probably underground in some underground chamber. Now, people are going to say, well, that's just like Raiders of the Lost Ark. It may be. You know, I don't know, but I do know that the viewers were blind and that the data correlated like that. So why it did, I don't know. The suggestion is that maybe the Ark is underground in under some city in the Middle East. My own impression that it was Jerusalem, that it's still in Jerusalem. So, of course, that's analysis after the fact, but that was the impression I got.
Did you guys call Ed Dames Dr. Doom in those days?
I don't think so, but it's possible. I kind of don't remember. He's been called that so much in present time,
right,
that it's overlaid what I remember from the past as far as how we referred to him. He certainly was Dr. Doom back then. I mean, he presented us numerous end-of-the-world scenarios while he was with us at Fort Meade, and at first we actually believed them. After a while, we started taking them with a grain of salt, but nonetheless, you know, it kept us on the edge of our seats sometimes. It was kind of fun.
All right, let's go to the first-time caller line. Welcome to Coast to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Is that me?
Yes, sir. It is.
Hi.
All you. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm John in Scituate, Massachusetts.
Patty, okay. Glad to hear from you.
It's the first time I listened to you for ages. You guys have helped me go through a lot of snow plowing.
Oh, that's good.
You need to move from Massachusetts.
I emailed you, George, a few times about using remote viewing on with POW MIA.
Yes, I remember
Vietnam.
That. Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't trust the government to do anything with remote viewing. But I'm wondering, could that ever be now, after all these years, to do anything like that with remote viewing?
In fact, we did do that at Fort Meade. You said you don't trust the government to do it. We actually did a pretty credible job of it. There was an attempted effort earlier in the program, but then when we came online as fully trained controlled remote viewers, coordinate remote viewers back then, one of our very first projects was to remote view a possible location of POW MIAs. And I actually go into this in pretty good detail in my book, so if anybody's interested, they might want to seek that out. But It was very carefully done, very sincerely wanting to find out ground truth. And at least in the locations we were targeted, and I'm not saying that elsewhere might not be the case, but in the locations we were targeted, we produced pretty persuasive evidence that there were no American POW MIAs at those locations. We developed indicators that they had been there in the past, and it was hard to tell how far back, but at the time we were remote viewed, there were none in those locations at that time.
Well, what about doing them now?
Well, it could be done. Again, it's kind of challenging because, well, you could task the remote viewer, okay, describe American POW MIAs in Southeast Asia present time. And if the viewer produced information, that would be an indicator, but it wouldn't be proof. And the reason for that is a odd phenomenon known as telepathic overlay, where, and I'll use the UFO example here because it's more clear-cut and obvious. Let's say that someone wants you to remote view a UFO event. Now, some UFO events probably really did happen. There's others that are just imagination, that they didn't happen. And let's say this is one of those cases where you want you to remote view a UFO event. It never happened. But the tasker, the person that's giving you the assignment, really believes it did happen and has this mental idea of how that thing unfolded. Well, the viewer subconscious goes out into RV space, whatever that is, you know, out in the ether, and the subconscious finds, well, there's nothing here. Nothing happened. But the conscious awareness isn't aware of that, keeps looking. And so the subconscious then looks for the next most powerful psychic signal. Well, it just happens to be the beliefs of the tasking person. And so the viewer comes back with this report, yeah, there's UFO, you know, all this kind of stuff, right? And so the tasker then is reinforced in his or her belief that it really did happen, even though it didn't. Are you following me?
Yeah, I gotcha.
Okay, so it's possible that if you're tasked by a person who really believes there's still POW MIAs out there, and I'm not committed one way or the other on this, obviously there are still people missing in action. There's no question about that. If the person really believes that they're out there in a certain place, then the viewer goes out there and, let's say, finds nothing, nonetheless may come back and report because of this telepathic overlay that there are POWs and MIAs out there, and you can't really tell unless you can get actual on-the-ground verification of some way. And then, of course, you've answered the question on your own.
So it's because it's swayed by their own personal belief.
It can be, yes. It's always dangerous to have someone tasking, viewing, or assisting in some way who has a very strong personal involvement or investment in a project.
Okay, so you wouldn't get a veteran who has strong beliefs to do it.
You probably wouldn't want to do that. You'd want to get somebody who's neutral because then you can rely on the data a little bit better.
Ah, I gotcha. Oh, great. Thank you, Paul.
You bet. Right. Thanks for the question.
Thank you, George. I appreciate it very much.
Okay, John. Appreciate you being part of the program. That is a good way to do it, Paul, because if you bring people in who have, I guess we can say a bias, for lack of a better phrase and word, it could skew the remote viewing.
Absolutely. It makes it harder to tell whether you've got real data or not. I want to jump in for a second because I realized we forgot to follow through on a promise we made earlier, and that was to tell people how they could actually having a remote viewing experience themselves.
Oh, we didn't forget. I was ready to pounce on that.
Oh, were you?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you want to pounce now? I'll give it just a very brief answer, actually.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, this is kind of a shortcut. Actually, I have put on both my website and on the International Remote Viewing Association website a general discussion about how you can set up your own remote viewing experiment. And if you go to either of those websites, my website, rviewer.com, I guess for people who may not have access to the web, rviewer.com, and the International Remote Viewing Association is IRVA, IRVA.org. Both of those have the same article there on how you can actually set up your own remote viewing experience and try it out for yourself.
All right, very good. Wildcard Line, you're up on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Yes, hello?
Yes, sir. Hi. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. My name's Doug from Ridgefield, Washington.
Oh, howdy. I was up there not long ago.
Oh, great, great.
My brother lives in Kennewick.
Okay, yeah. Hey, George, I just want to say I really appreciate the show. Great stuff that you've been
Thank you, Dash.
sharing with the world here. It's so important. And Paul, especially what you're talking about is really fascinating. And I just have a couple of comments. First, a question. Are you familiar with the work of David Hawkins?
Yes.
Yes. He's come up with a, you know, you're talking about distinguishing the truth of something versus the falsehood of it.
Yes.
He's come up with a very foolproof way using kinesiology.
I'm sorry,
kinesiology, using kinesiology.
Oh, really?
To verify the truth of something. He discovered that a body will test weak in the presence of a lie. And, you know, strong in the presence of truth. And, you know, so he has been, he's actually in Sedona. You mentioned being in Sedona.
Uh-huh.
Coming up here. He's got a spiritual research institute down there. Very fascinating fellow. Co-wrote a book with Linus Pauling on neuropsychiatry and such. But my point is that... You're right on, and what some of the things you're saying really are in line with his work, and you know, this whole remote viewing thing is very true and very accurate, and the skeptics don't get it yet because they're working from a limited paradigm.
Mm-hmm.
And my other point was, and I'll listen to your comments off the line, was that so much of what we're discovering in parapsychology and in the spiritual realms are things that are already validated in other spiritual cultures on the planet, particularly the Hindu culture and the Chinese culture, more advanced spiritual cultures, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just would love to hear your comments on that.
Yes, I think they are more advanced in certain respects, and of course, but they are not as advanced in other respects. No culture is perfect, obviously, and some cultures have advantages, others don't have, and vice versa. I think they do have an advantage in that they are perhaps more closely attuned to what we might call spiritual aspects of human nature, and that's good. The West could learn some things from that. Whether or not we will, who knows?
Yeah, I do. We don't hear of Chinese remote viewers, though, do we?
Well, you know, of course they have the Qigong, which I think there's some relevant relationships between the two. There is some indication that Chinese are looking into this stuff fairly seriously. Now, of course, you run into the problem that they have a Marxist government right now. And Marxism, by definition, is a materialist, and bound to be a bit dubious about all this. Consequently, any research into the field at all is going to be heavily controlled and probably working from some sort of physicalist or materialist perspective, which I think if you limit yourself to that, you're bound to not make the kind of progress that you would if you would acknowledge that some things in the world may not in fact be physical or material.
Let's go next to our West of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Good morning, Paul. Good morning, George. This is Steve calling from KSTE.
Sure,
Sacramento.
Mm-hmm.
How are you?
Good.
We spoke not that long ago, George. I'm the person whose grandmother visited me and the furniture was moved in the house.
Right. I remember that.
Yeah. You have my phone number, the producer. I gave it to him. Anyway, I called because you mentioned on that occasion that I have visions on occasion, and I've never really applied myself, but once in a while, there'll be an item where someone was abducted and they couldn't find the body. And I have in my mind, I get a picture of the person and the posture and whether they're beneath the ground, if they're laying on the side, back, if they're near a tree or near a water, or which direction they're facing and, you know, in relation to boat or something. And sometimes I can actually get a general geographical location within like 4 or 5 miles of where this might be found. I don't know if that is a remote viewing or if there's something there that I can work with, that I can help someone with. I just know.
Yeah. I have to tell you, actually, it's kind of funny. When you said abducted, I was thinking aliens for a minute.
Now, but this one was a real one, yeah.
Abducted by in some criminal act or other. What you've described could very possibly be a sort of just spontaneous remote viewing kind of experience. And you've described it the way remote viewing kind of does it, where you get the surroundings, the setting of the target, whatever that target may be, in this case apparently an abducted person, but you really can't say, well, I know where that is. You would recognize the spot perhaps when you got there, or if you recognize something that is sort of a landmark, you could do that. You could guide people to it. But that's the big problem in what we call a search problem remote viewing, is providing locational data, not just describing the setting that the target is in. There's not, it's actually, you probably can't help much unless you in some way refine your information so that you can provide guidance for somebody who's actually searching for that person. And it might be that you'll identify some particular landmark or some characteristics of the target that could be useful. Now, on the other hand, it may not be veridical at all. People do get, have impressions, have experiences that turn out to be some other, quirk of psychology or whatever. And it doesn't mean you're crazy or anything. This just happens to people. In fact, one of the big obstacles to overcome in remote viewing is something we call analytical overlay, which is basically your left brain trying to tell your right brain what it's experiencing.
You could actually, you could think yourself out of good remote viewing.
You can. In fact, that's a very high probability thing in remote viewing, unless you learn how to deal with that overlay.
Ed Dames was telling me, Paul, that the less you concentrate, just by letting things float into your head, mm-hmm. and then, you know, jot them down, draw sketches, whatever you do, that is the proper way for him. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when he starts to trying to analyze and think, mm-hmm. he said it never works.
Well, never a bit strong, but it's unlikely to work, let's put it that way, because there's always exceptions in remote viewing. But generally, I'd say that's a pretty good way of putting it. There's no real good way of explaining how it feels or how it's like. Everybody has a different way of explaining it, but I think they're all trying to express and describe the same experience. Remote viewing is, again, a bit zen-like in that you don't try and quiet your mind, you don't try and blank your mind, you know, chase every thought out of it. First of all, that's impossible anyway, just because of the way our minds work. But it's more of a zen process where you will let it come in, you sort it out, and let it go out to where it should go out. So you learn to recognize analytical overlay, and you learn what to do with it. And you let it come in, and you let it go out. And when you succeed in being able to do that consistently, your remote viewing ability improves dramatically.
I was going to say, the more you can practice, the better you should get. Is that the case?
As long as you're practicing correctly. Now, obviously, if you're going to play the piano and you practice the song wrong every time, you're going to reinforce the wrong thing.
Right? You're going to play it wrong. That's right.
That's right. And the same thing happens with remote viewing. If you don't get the principles down right, fortunately, there's a fair amount of leeway, but nonetheless, if you don't get the principles right, if you practice it incorrectly, you're not going to progress at the rate you may want to.
All right, well, stick with us. We're going to be back for final phone calls with our special guest, Paul Smith, Reading the Enemy's Mind. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. You talk about synchronicity. A friend of my sister's in Detroit, she was having dinner with her friend, and this person had a podcast with them, and she said, well, what is this thing? He says, oh, I podcast Coast to Coast. And she says, Coast to Coast, is that with that George Norrie guy? And he said, yeah, it's with George and Art Bell. I've been podcasting for a couple months now. I love it. And she said, did you know that he's the brother of my best friend? And the guy couldn't believe it. It was just a great story. Small world, isn't it? Well, we'll be back in a moment with Paul Smith and the rest of your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie with Paul Smith. Paul, did Ingo Swann ever talk with you about what he thinks he remote viewed on the moon regarding aliens on the moon and bases? It's an incredible story.
He didn't talk directly about that, but as a matter of fact, I guess I can talk about this now. he asked me to do some sessions for him against anomalies on the moon. And he gave me his essentially final collection of the, and it included sessions he'd worked, sessions another person had worked, and plus my sessions as well. And there were some very interesting, again, very interesting correlations between those other sessions and the material I developed. Now, of course, I know some of his other stories. None of that material, for example, that's in his book Penetration, ended up in being subject to, you know, the things I remote viewed or the things in this particular project. But nonetheless, very intriguing. I think we need to go find out what's going on there.
What do you think is going on there?
Well, I'm very cautious about this stuff. I can tell you what my remote viewing session developed to some degree. It's been a while since I looked at it, but I think I did three or four of them. Whether or not it's veridical, you know, I can't say until we go and check it out. I mean, it could be, again, a case of telepathic overlay. Maybe Ingo believed something about what's going on the moon. But nonetheless, just based on what I had in my sessions, there do seem to be some odd things going on involving apparent intelligent-type activity. a lot of it seems to be underground, and there are some coming and going with some kind of transportation device. That was basically what my information developed and my sessions developed. Again, I'm not saying it's really like that. All I know is what I worked in a essentially blind, remote viewing blind condition. I produced that data, and it did correlate with some of the other material developed by Ingo and this other fellow.
So we have separate sources then coming up with somewhat similar circumstances.
Yes. Now, again, it's potentially separate. There's always the danger of telepathic overlay in an operation like that. But nonetheless, in a way, I'm not ready to dismiss it. There was something kind of compelling about it in a way.
So. That's fascinating. Yeah. That absolutely is. How's Ingo's health these days? Have you talked to him?
I haven't talked to him in the last week or so. I understand he's got a pretty bad case of the flu, which is why I haven't contacted him. I didn't want to disturb him in those circumstances. But
because was sick before that, wasn't he?
Well, he had a very serious accident. He slipped on the ice, and, you know, of course, he's now in his 70s, and put him in the hospital for about 2 weeks. But he's recovered pretty well from that. And now he's got the flu, and I hope that's all it amounts to, because he's going to be one of our primary speakers at the remote viewing conference. And in fact, if anybody wants to meet Ingo Swann, this could be the time to do it, because, you know, he is getting on. He would hate to hear me say that, but he is getting on, you know, and he may decide not to come to any more of these. So if you have the chance, one more plug for the remote viewing conference in May.
Well, I think I have to go to a wedding on that weekend, Paul. If not, I'd love to come up there and see you and Ingo.
Well, you know, you have a standing invitation.
Thank you. And he'd probably love to hear some stories about my aunt.
He'd love to talk to you about that, too. You know, there must be some way we can get you two together in the same room at the same time for a while. He would love it, I'm sure, and I think that you'd find it fascinating as well.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. Let's pick it up by going to our East of the Rockies line. You're on the air with Paul Smith. Hi there.
Hello, this is Jacob.
Hello.
Hi, Jacob. Go ahead.
From Chanute, Kansas.
Oh, cool.
I got a question. Now, they say that 10% or something like that of the population is left-handed, which they do, which that some people, or I don't know how much research has been done, but they do think in their right mind, correct?
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily?
No, because the hands are cross-wired, and just because you're left-handed doesn't necessarily mean you lean towards use of your right brain. In fact, there's a lot of engineers who tend to be linear thinkers, not across the board, but tend to be, that are left-handed. So
you're saying, like for my instance, I write left-handed, eat left-handed, throw left-handed, but actually I'm right-eye dominant.
Mm-hmm.
Kick right-footed, bat right-footed, golf right-footed, or right-handed. You know what I'm saying? Kind of like, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. You know, all of us are a bit mixed up.
Yeah.
You know, very few of us are unified in one direction or the other.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. I think that's it. Thank you very much, guys.
Okay. Appreciate you being part of the program. Next up, we'll go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Good morning, George. Good morning, Paul.
This is
Sid calling from Norfolk.
Sure.
I was stationed.
I'm sorry, what was your name?
Sid.
Sid, and from where?
Norfolk.
Oh, Norfolk. I love that town. Right, go ahead.
I've got three peculiar questions. You referenced General Stubblebine earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Twice in my military career, I met him. Once was at an electronics depot a couple hours outside of D.C.
Okay.
And only met him for about 5 minutes. 2.5 years later, met him again at a briefing I was giving in Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And amongst all the officers present, he stopped me right at the beginning. He says, I know you from somewhere.
Mm.
Before the end of this briefing, I'll tell you exactly where.
Scary, isn't
now,
it?
During my briefing, he stood there semi-half dazed but still paying attention. And at the end of the briefing, he told me where and when he met me down to the day.
That's impressive.
Is
of course,
he
did he remember what you said in the briefing?
Yes.
Oh, good. That's impressive. Now, he's a sharp guy.
He being the top of the food chain on the military side of the remote viewers, was he also trained in it?
Not formally. I think he did play around with it a bit. He tended to get more involved in the PK stuff, the metal bending, and he used that as an object lesson whenever he went around the places. In fact, in my book, I detail that was my first encounter with any of this stuff was Stubblebine giving a talk to the combined career schools there at Fort Huachuca. And he starts tossing out bent silverware, you know, psychically bent silverware out in the audience and saying that he and his staff did that. And we're talking about generals and senior colonels and lieutenant colonels. That was pretty astonishing for most of us, you know. So that was interesting. He's an amazing guy. Were you an MI officer?
No, I was enlisted. Fort Devens, the other half of the Intel Center and schools.
Of course, I started out enlisted. So what was your MOS?
33 Sierra.
Oh, okay. All right. Good.
This brings up the other question.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the stressful nature of the course, a major came in there, and we all had a stress relaxation techniques class.
Mm-hmm.
Laying out on the grass, arms out to our sides, palms up, feet together.
Hoping no one could see you, right?
Do not fall asleep, no matter what you do. Do not fall asleep and just listen to me.
Okay.
And they talked us literally out of our bodies.
Mm-hmm.
Immediately after that, we went into a clearance investigate or background check again.
Mm-hmm.
And they asked us, have you ever sleepwalked? They kept reiterating that question throughout the interview.
Huh.
Now, would better question be, have you ever dreamed that you've been walking around and look back and see your body laying somewhere? Instead of, have you ever sleepwalked since you're under a clearance background check?
Well, my guess is those were two separate events. The first one was, probably, what year was this?
This was 79 or very early 80.
Okay. The relaxation exercise was probably done under the auspices of the INSCOM Search for Excellence, which was a program to try and take some of these human development technologies out and introduce them to the intelligence core.
Okay.
The other thing, my guess, was a standard psychological evaluation that they often did, and you know, for the compartmented clearances that you'd have had to require, that you would have had to have. I don't think they were connected. I'm sorry?
Here's the weird part. My mother passed away in 78, but 2 weeks before she passed away, she started collecting Paul Revere silverware, or silver sets and whatnot.
Uh-huh.
One of the questions on the forms we were filling out said, are you a member of any national organizations, for example, the ACLU, which at that time I'd never heard of, or the Paul Revere Society?
Uh-huh.
The Paul Revere Society, as I find out later from another talk show host, doesn't even exist until 1993. Could it have been remote viewed and perceived as a possible threat in the future?
I doubt that. I think you got to do some research on that. I seem to recall hearing about that society long before 1993.
It was on the forum in 79 and 80.
Yeah. I don't think that's unusual. I think it was an organization similar to the John Birch Society, if I'm not mistaken. I could be wrong. You know, that's a long time ago. But I doubt that it would have been remote viewed and put on a questionnaire. That would be very unusual. That wasn't the kind of thing that we would have worked, and we were the only ones doing it. In the Army at that, well, I wasn't even in the program yet, but, you know, Joe McMonigle and some of the early remote viewers were the only ones doing it in the Army at the time. So I doubt that that would work. But, you know, I don't know. If I were you, I'd research the Paul Revere Society a little bit more and find out if maybe it did exist before 1993. That just seems way too late to me from what I recall.
All right. Thanks for that call, Sid. Wildcard Line, you're up on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is Richard in Spring Hill, Florida.
Hey, Richard. Thanks for holding.
I appreciate you taking my call. I've listened to you for quite a while. I've got a question. I'm not sure. I got into this conversation late, and I'm curious, how long have you been doing this with the military?
Oh, forever. No, I started in 1983.
Okay. This was just a little earlier. Did you ever do a remote viewing on Bentwaters Woodbridge?
I have to tell you, I don't know. And the reason I don't know is because we worked a bunch of those kind of targets. Again, it was sub rosa. It was not an official tasking by any means. It was, you know, just kind of an attempt to find out what we could do with this stuff. And we worked a number of these, what I call anomaly targets, among them UFO-type events. And I identified some that I worked and that some of the others worked. And I don't recall if Bentwaters was one of them. And even if it wasn't any of the ones I found, it's still possible you worked it. I just haven't got the data on it.
It might have been better known as Rendlesham.
Oh, yes. Actually, we did work that.
Okay.
I don't know if I did, but I know I found two or three sessions of other folks. In the archives, in the Stargate archives, I found two or three sessions at least that other folks have worked on the Rendlesham Forest. Right now, I can't tell you off the top of my head what the results were. You know, it's been a while since I looked at it, and I've looked at so many sessions over the time. So,
interesting. I've never, ever talked about it with, you know, publicly about it. I've talked with friends about it, but I was 81st Security Police Squadron. I was there.
Oh, really?
Yes, sir.
Send me an email. Get up on my website and send me an email.
You got it. It would be a pleasure to do that.
Okay.
Thanks for being on the program. Next up, west of the Rockies, it's your turn. Hi there.
Hi.
Yes, sir. Take it away.
Hi. I have a question. I am a civilian employee of the Air Force and work at Edwards Air Force Base. I grew up just east of there, and my family lives in a small valley where a few times a year they have triangles fly over every night. That will go on for a month to a month and a half. And they will fly over three or four times in the night, and there's about three different ones. So I was wondering, have you ever remote viewed or can shed any information on what these triangles are?
I haven't, actually. One of the things you have to be aware of about remote viewing is you can't pick the targets for yourself. So, for example... Let's say I was curious to find out about this. I could not target myself on that because, again, you'd be front-loaded if you did that. All of what you can suspect or think and infer about it is right there and messes up your session. In order to get that information, I would have to task somebody else on that who didn't know what I was giving them to do. And I have never done that. Actually, it didn't occur to me to do it. But then I'm not much into UFOs. I've written a couple articles for UFO Magazine, but they have to do with, you know, the pretty much past history of RV and UFOs and things like that. And I do have in mind to do some more, and so maybe eventually I'll become an expert on UFOs, but I'm not there yet. So.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you.
You bet. Thanks for your question.
Okay. Appreciate it. Did you know, by the way, Paul, that Bill Burns and I highlight you somewhat in our new book, Worker in the Light, which won't be out until September?
Well, Bill had said he might say some things about me. I have no idea still to what extent that is. But
we said some good things about you.
Well, I am very pleased. In my next book, I'll say good things about you, too.
Okay. And then on my next one after that, I'll say good things about you.
Hey, I think we've got a real good deal going here.
You've got it. Let's take another call. First time caller line, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Thanks.
My name is Chris. I'm calling from Washington.
Okay,
Chris.
And I had a question. You kind of answered this a little bit before, but I was wondering, like, could you remote view, like, to other planets?
Actually, that's been done. Of course, there's the lunar things I talked about. And then Ingo Swann is famous for having remote viewed Jupiter before one of our space probes got there and identified that Jupiter, like Saturn, has rings. We just couldn't see them from here. interestingly as well, some of our training targets were Mars. Now, some of them are a little more controversial than others. Joel McMonigle, for example, is famous for having remote viewed Mars and described underground facilities and an ancient race of Martians which was no longer there and a whole bunch of stuff. He talks about that in his book, Mind Trek. He has since questioned whether he was really remote viewing Mars or instead picking up on stuff he read later on in his life, and that kind of polluted the signal. Who knows what that is? But a little more straightforward, one of our targets was, what is it? Was it a Viking that landed on Mars? I forget. One of our earliest Mars landers was one of our targets. A number of the remote viewers at Fort Meade, just as a training, were given the coordinates for that and actually described it fairly accurately. And so there you go. You can remote view another planet.
Okay, I got one other question.
Okay.
Sure, go ahead.
I was wondering if it's possible to remote view and not know it, and then maybe, say, go to the place you remote viewed and have deja vu?
I'd say it's possible. I'm not quite sure how you'd tell that's what happened, but, you know, it's within the realm of possibility, and that's probably the best answer I can give you.
You know how we were earlier talking about how it takes time to see and then have the brain register, so it's almost like we're time traveling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Paul, what are the possibilities that deja vu truly is just that? Events that we see that we really haven't registered yet, and then somehow the mind flips it.
Well, of course, that's one of the explanations for deja vu. You know, a scientifically based one, I guess you could say. The idea is that it's just kind of a delay loop in the brain, temporary delay loop that makes you think you've experienced it a second time, when in reality you're just perceiving it in a delayed way. I think that deja vu is probably explainable that way, but I think there probably are deja vu experiences where you do have some precognitive awareness of that event. The pure thing about it is oftentimes there's no real meaningful content there. Oftentimes when you have spontaneous psi, when people experience a spontaneous psychic event, there's some real meaning. You know, their child is in danger, a relative has died, those kinds of things. Those are things that are reported. Louisa Ryan made a large study of those kinds of things. But these deja vu things oftentimes are just meaningless. They're just, you know, there they are. Doesn't have any.
They're just out there. Paul, thanks for being on the program.
Oh, you are quite welcome.
The enemy's mind, Paul Smith. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Rob Ismail, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, and Ian Punnett and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.